Greetings, my friends, and welcome to The Paula Gordon Show, Conversations with People at the Leading Edge. I'm Paula. Inheritance is a more complex bargain than is generally thought. Who of us would not want to inherit great wealth? And if that inheritance includes madness, what then? Millicent Monks is the great-grandniece of Andrew Carnegie, in his time one of the richest men on earth. But great wealth could not protect her from her mother's illness or rescue her daughter from the same disease.
Gets confused.
Yeah.
And I think guilt, huge part of it. I mean, first of all, they said our daughter was schizophrenic, and that was my fault. Do you remember that? There was a whole period when the schizophrenic mother was...
And that was blamed on you. You did it. This is the most intimate relationship in all of one's life is mother-daughter.
And you are blamed for doing this terrible behavior that your child is carrying on. I mean, it's just horrible. And then the same with the borderline thing. I mean, still today, I read something that hints that maybe it was me, and now I know it's in the brain, so that's a huge relief. But... even with borderline, there was, the family's done this to the child. And that's the most horrendous thing, to think that you might have harmed your child that way.
Millicent Monks has written a memoir of her life titled Songs of Three Islands. She has told this story to help us face and cope with mental illness. It is a story of trial, endurance, and perhaps of peace.
Millicent Monks, you let me call you Millie, yes?
Yes.
Yes. I've been thinking as I've been listening to the stories that you tell and reading the stories that you tell in the stories of Three Islands, I've been thinking how important our stories are to us. The stories that we tell and how important the stories that we don't or won't or can't tell. Is that part of what drives you to sit down with me in this beautiful place in Cape Elizabeth, Maine, that you've called home for so many years, to be talking about those stories? Is it the importance of those stories that pulls you out of your quietness into conversation?
Well, I'm not kind of used to the word important, I guess, but... I don't know. Most of them seem to come to me at about 4 in the morning. So. But it's as if it was coming from somewhere else, almost.
You've experienced 4 in the morning for many, 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 many
yes.
years. You
yes.
talk about being a young woman, a very young woman,
yes.
and the, shall we say, challenges of growing up when the night was a real refuge for you as well
yes.
as a fearful place.
Yes.
And maybe they come together.
I think once I was felt safe in my room, I think the night was a refuge, definitely.
Because the day was
too complicated, too difficult, and I already felt like I think because of my feeling what my mother was telling me. I'm not sure that she even was aware of it, but I think I needed to assimilate that somehow. And I became feeling like a stranger in the world. It didn't feel comfortable to me. I mean, how do you function in this strange world? So when I got in my room, it was quiet.
Refuge is a wonderful concept. That's the good news. The bad news is that one needs to take refuge, isn't it?
Yes. Yes, and you have to learn not to be a stranger in the world.
If one is going to participate in it
yes.
at all.
Yes.
Well, I think that the part of why this, I'm sure, has a double or triple or quadruple level of intrigue is there is this sense that in America where our values have gotten very confused or poisoned, that if you're rich, if you have money, everything is going to be fine. You come from one of the wealthiest families in the world over time. And
right.
to be a Carnegie and to know your heritage well and still be faced with these fundamental issues, that's humbling.
Well, I don't think the family never talked about being Carnegies. That it was not polite. you didn't do that. It was like mental illness in those days, you know. You just didn't talk about it. So it just seemed perfectly natural. I didn't know how anybody else lived. So, and then it certainly wasn't much help to me going to my room. I don't know where the Carnegies were around to help me out.
All those Scotsmen.
Yeah, where were they?
Well, indeed, where were they?
Where were they? Yeah.
The whole question of mental health, mental illness, that big, gray, secret place, is something I want to talk about, since you are willing, when we come back in just a moment. Yeah. Thank you for joining me in this conversation. This is Millie Monks. We are in Cape Elizabeth, Maine, a beautiful place that she calls home, and we both will be back in just a moment. We are back with Millicent Millie Monks, here in what has been your home for many,
yes,
maybe all of the years of your life. Haven't you thought of this, as you say, island, as a grounding of,
yes,
sorts?
Yes.
If you would, describe those three islands, and why do you pick those as metaphors? You think of yourself, I think, as a metaphor.
Yes.
Is that a meta-metaphor?
I'm not sure. It's a metaphor, I guess.
why three islands?
Well, I think in the Vedic tradition, you are born and you are with a mother, and that's the first part of your life. And the Cumberland Island was run by a matriarch, very, very powerful matriarch, and my aunt was the next matriarch of Cumberland.
Now, who really were these people?
That was Bertha Carnegie. She was married to Thomas Carnegie. And then my aunt married a Rockefeller, so she was a Nancy Carnegie Rockefeller. But they were very powerful women. So I think, and this was my mother's place, so I think of that island as being the feminine. And it crawling trees and snakes and quick death and moisture. And then the middle island, this island, is the according to the Vedic tradition, then you go from the mother to the family and to work and to play. And that's what this island is, and it's sort of closer to civilization. And the third island is the island of the spiritual island. And there the light is crystal clear and the trees are straight and there's a chapel. So that's how I came to think of that. The three islands.
And the third island is not simply spiritual, it also, in fact, on the ground, is,
yes,
the patriarchal.
And thank you very much, it is the patriarchal.
So yes. Say more of that.
Yes, well, I think the elders in the third phase of their life go into the forest to study the spiritual life, to get ready for death. That's what they do, and it is very patriarchal. I mean, I think God and death and all those things are all male.
And then there is the monks' family.
Yes. And there are Boston patriarchs that go up there, so they're very craggy.
Craggy, good heavens. Well, if one thinks of... I don't think in the Vedic tradition.
Right.
So it is interesting to me, you being deeply American, how is it that you think in the Vedic tradition? How did you find your way to that?
Well, I suppose it started out by being interested in religion, getting confirmed, and keep looking and looking. And I tried to go to the Episcopal Theological School, but they wouldn't let me be a minister in those days.
And because?
I was a woman.
Silly question.
Well, I'm sorry, I should have mentioned that.
No. Well, I'm sorry, they should have ignored that.
I know. Then I got sick, I had cancer, and I thought I wasn't going to live. So then I began to explore other things and started meditating.
And that took you into the Eastern traditions?
Into the Eastern tradition and studying Vedic tradition. And
you found something there that was deeper, bigger, other?
Absolutely fascinating to me. I mean, I think the tremendously old knowledge, I think it's 5,000-year-old knowledge that the Hindus or the Vedic tradition brings to us, really is probably gives the religions we have today their knowledge.
And foundations, perhaps?
Yeah. And they, St. Thomas was buried in India, and they say if you go to India that Christ, of course, was here and studied here. That was the 40 days in the wilderness was the years he spent in India. Now, I don't know, but that was sort of fascinating to me. So,
you use the image of the cross quite regularly in your in the stories of Three Islands.
Right.
It's not that you have removed yourself from the Christian tradition,
no.
It seems. And in fact, your ordination was at St. John the Divine, was it
right.
not? I am so fascinated by that. Will you tell me what, after all those years and all that journey, how did you end up at St. John the Divine in New York City being ordained?
Well, it's an interfaith religion, and they chose it. I have no idea why, but I guess being interfaith, we could have gone anywhere.
Well, did you march down aisles? Did you wear robes? Did the birds sing? What?
Well, we had Hindus, we had Muslims, we had Catholic, we had Episcopalians, we had witches, and we had healers. So everybody had their own thing that they brought to it, which was interfaith.
And each of you then was ordained?
Yeah.
One of my very favorite moments in the year comes at the winter solstice, when every year I put on the my brother gave me many years ago, I guess it was my brother and sister-in-law, gave me a recording of the Paul Winter Consort.
Right.
Paul Winter Consort Concert. that took place at St. John the Divine. And this would have been in the, maybe early 80s. They've been doing it a very long time.
Beautiful.
And it had the whales, and it was just
beautiful.
It was. Is that the spirit that resides at this quite unusual cathedral?
Well, you know, I think we went to a part of the cathedral that was under construction, part of it was, so we didn't get to that beautiful spot, I'm afraid. But it was a very nice place.
Very nice indeed.
Part of the cathedral, but I think they were working on the cathedral or something. So.
Well, I specifically thought of that as we sit here in Cape Elizabeth, Maine, with picture card perfect weather. I don't know quite how you did that for us.
Very hard.
And you succeeded very well. But I was thinking, as I often do, from that concert by the Paul Winter Consort.
Right.
It has a wonderful song in it. The sea is where all life begins.
That's lovely. I don't know it.
It's a worthy beautiful song, and beauty, it seems to me, is part of what we're talking about as we talk of the Three Islands, as we talk about the work you've done over a lifetime in your pursuit of the arts. Isn't, you say of St. John that it was a beautiful place, isn't beauty, doesn't that have a great deal to do with the way you have spent your life force?
I find it almost more beautiful just to look at the ocean than to be in a cathedral or a church. But I've been threatening to build this crystal dome that'll be just a dome for women. It'll be a female church, and it'll be right on the ocean. So,
why would it be just for women?
I don't know. Just because I'd like to be in a place where there's just female spirit, and it didn't have a steeple on it, which is so masculine.
It is indeed. That's quite a phallic symbol, isn't it?
Yeah, and I had a hard time sometimes. I'm so glad I graduated, because I would say things like, well, I think we need to have something other than the Ten Commandments now, because those are commandments from a man, and we have a hard time keeping one of them. Doesn't it say, thou shalt not kill? Maybe we need 10 female suggestions.
I love it. 10 females. Where would we start? What would some of them be?
Haven't gotten that far.
Well, you could think of what. Would it start with "Thou shalt not kill" as a?
I don't think so.
What kind of bubbles up? What kind of suggestions has your now long life?
I think it would have something to do with starting to look inside, and finding the peace that passes all understanding there instead of outside. Thou shalt enjoy the time you meditate, and shall grow in consciousness that way. I don't know.
It's interesting you talk about the outside, inside. I had a friend who died at 104. And when she was about 102, she lived at a distance from me, so I had to travel to her. So we treated our time as very precious, she said. And she was from Vienna. Mm. Paula, she would say. Paula, if we were not in a hurry. She had been approached by a very aggressive religionist who was intent on converting her before she died so that she wouldn't go to hell and burn forever.
Dear.
And this woman had spent her life respectfully, but quite secularly, and she looked at me very hard and she said, "Should I listen to her?"
What did you say?
Well, I was trying very hard to not be judgmental and to say to her, some traditions look inside rather than outside. I don't think I said it as well as you have. But that one could find ways to die in peace, because that, of course, was the issue.
Right.
That were within oneself. And I said to her, I think that you have spent time within yourself that has given you a sense of peace and fulfillment and grace, if you will. And I said the person who was selling, unfortunately, was looking for answers outside of herself.
Right.
Is that what you're talking about?
Yeah, and I think that we have such a misunderstanding of death, but that's another whole subject for another book. But I think Bobby's godson is a doctor in London, and he had Crohn's disease. Mm. And he eventually died officially on the operating table and came back. And he said, "Millie," he said, "it was the most beautiful thing that ever happened to me. It was like being picked up in my mother's arms." His mother had died having him. When he was five, she died. She told she shouldn't. And he said, "I will never be afraid of death again." And I thanked him when we went back to London this time. It was 4 years later, and I said, "Wiz, thank you so much for telling me that, because that's been a wonderful thing to know."
Indeed. Let's go away so that we can come back to that very important subject. We'll be back in just a moment. Be with us. It is my great pleasure, I being Paula Gordon, to be with Millie Monks. I think in America particularly, maybe more so than most any place, because we're so committed to our stuff, that we just don't want to talk about death, we don't want to think about death. There is a great aversion, active aversion, to the subject that is death. And we might be denying ourselves some very good news, as your
friend said.
Indeed. Don't you think it quite remarkable, when everything that lives is going to die, that we ignore it, that we push it away, that we don't think of death as part of life?
No.
Don't we deny ourselves something by virtue of that?
I think in a sense I was lucky in my book that I felt that my mother, that was my mother's message. And that was really what started me off being interested in it.
Because really?
I don't think most people certainly are.
No, indeed.
And and then, of course, I did get to say one sentence to the Maharishi. My good husband got the other half an hour. They couldn't stop talking. Maharishi Mahesh Yoga. And I asked him, I said, "Is meditating a small death?" And he was quiet for a minute. And he said, "Yes."
Meditation has been very important to you. Is it since the cancer?
Probably started then.
And you chose the transcendental meditation, the TM approach. Did you happen into that? Were you? There are many, many, many paths.
There are. Yes, I did. There was a place next door, and I ended up, I had 2 years of chemo when I had cancer, pretty regularly. And at one point they told me I could not continue because my white blood count was too low. And I said, "Well, give me 2 weeks and let me see what I can do." So I just meditated very, very carefully, and I was what they call a siddha by then, which is the levitating sutras. And it was so happy. I would sit in the bed and I'd go up and down. I mean, this is the middle of thinking, you know, maybe I'm not going to make this. I went back and my white blood count was fine. But now they're discovering all sorts of the Buddhists, and they're meditating, and the happiness that comes with meditating for the Buddhists. And so they're opening up all that.
Now, I think it is very funny to be sitting in Maine, that very proper state, in this very proper part of the country, New Englanders who don't do a lot on the subject of happiness as a culture.
That's true.
Isn't there a seeking in that alone, that to be pursuing happiness when you could be, well, let's see, what do the Puritans pursue?
not happiness.
No. And in a way, it seems that that's part of our loss in not thinking about death, because it doesn't give us the room to say, let us rejoice in the moment.
Yes, and those that do meditate tremendously long hours and for many, many years are very happy.
I remember my mother was quite puritanical in her own way, and I remember once saying to her something that a major turn in my life that I thought that I could pursue happiness, and she looked at me and said, happiness is not the point of life.
Oh, well.
And then I had a good counselor who said happiness was worth pursuing.
And I think that's one of the Maharishi's great gifts that he left us with, is happiness. Well, they claim to be in a state of bliss. I'm very envious, but the long-term meditators.
I think that your coping with mental illness has been a meditation. I partly think about it because you had to do it in private, almost secret, and mental health, wellness, illness is such a foreign country to us.
Yes. It's so sad.
Is this something that has been part of your life always?
Mental illness?
Yeah.
Well, I think my mother wasn't well. And I think the particular illness in the family, I'm beginning to think maybe is inherited. I mean, I think the borderline personality is inherited. Actually, just recently, in the last maybe 6 months, they've discovered where it lies in the brain. And it lies in the brain where anger is held. I can't remember what part of the brain.
That would be the limbic, probably.
Limbic brain. Mm. And that's very typical of borderline personalities, is the rage. Huge rage that they can't control.
That they can't control.
They can't control it. And that they found that means that in 3 or 4 years, maybe they'll find something that they can, some way to help them.
Is meditation one of the ways that people are seeking to address this particular?
No.
No.
Well, I don't know. I mean, I don't think that people who have a serious mental illness find it easy to meditate.
Yeah. You talk about four generations within your family, which takes us back to your grandmother or great-grandmother.
Right.
So that there's a thread that runs through, but it doesn't touch everyone. And at least in your stories, you talk only about the women in the family.
Right.
Is that just lucky?
Lucky?
Yeah, that the men don't seem... they get off lighter on at least...
No.
At least that... well, there are things that are inherited along on the gender lines,
yeah.
So... When did you begin thinking in terms of mental illness and mental wellness, health and
health.
Disease.
For myself,
yes.
You mean? That's been fairly recent, actually. About 4 or 5 years ago, I could barely stand up. I went into Portland and fell down on the brick and was unconscious for 4 hours.
You just fell down?
Well, what had happened, and they said at the Mayo Clinic, it was stress and trauma. And that made me very dizzy, and it made my my legs would give out very quickly. And so anyway, I did a lot of work with a Jungian analyst about that. It's been wonderful. And I'm really almost over it. I think one of the things, it sounds very strange, is that one of the attributes of a borderline personality is they're very psychic, and so am I. I used to be very psychic, and I've kind of lost it. But they can invade you. And there is a book called Mount Misery that talks about this, about a young psychiatrist at the McLean's Hospital and how these doctors wouldn't take borderline patients because they began to feel they looked like them, or they should go jump out of a car, or they did something they didn't feel it belonged to them. And when I learned how to stop that, and I think that was, and doing a lot of meditating, I think I've sort of moved on.
It sounds like developing a psychological muscle almost.
Yes, thank you.
Is that right?
Yeah. It's a switch in the brain somehow.
When you talk about going to the Mayo Clinic and having them talk about stress, how do you get from stress and trauma, and it's important to talk about that trauma since you're willing to do so, to falling down? What is it they say happens physically? Because it's what this says to me is we are so much, this mind and body is all it
yes.
together, that there's
yes.
not a duality here.
Yes.
Is that some of what you're saying?
Well, I think they're learning a lot more about trauma now with the soldiers coming back from the war. So I think it's a fairly new thing, and the Mayo Clinic really wasn't much help. I think they're much more into it now than they were 5 years ago.
What kind of trauma? I mean, when you say trauma, what is in you, if to the extent you're willing to talk about it, what is the trauma of which you speak?
Well, I think first growing up and locking myself in my room every night and not being fed, that's pretty traumatic. So,
you mean literally?
Literally. And being so fearful. You know,
fearful of?
Well, I was going to find somebody sitting behind a curtain, my mother. Or,
and you had reason to fear that.
I had reason to fear that in the dark. Or it was a pretty terrible atmosphere to grow up in.
And your mother was violent?
No. I wouldn't. Well, she got very angry. She could get very angry. But
this isn't just mom getting mad and then
no.
go on to the next subject angry.
No, this is crawling on the floor angry.
Rage?
Really angry. Rage.
Crawling on the floor.
Well, she had done that once.
Yeah.
Screaming at my sister. And my sister left and just never went back.
And you
She's not with us now, so I don't mind saying
yeah,
that. But,
yeah. And you were too young, too frightened, too attached?
Well, I had
attached.
No place to go. It was the war. My father was in New Guinea with a nurse's station, and my brother had gone, and there was nobody.
You wouldn't think that a youngster who is born into one of the most wealthy places in the planet...
I know.
No place to go?
No place to go. Well, I didn't know any place to go anyway. I mean, and then she would refused to let my friend see me, and so I got kind of isolated. But that was before boarding school. But that was trauma. That will count as trauma.
Your father is another story that has all sorts of ramifications in your life as well.
Yeah.
Especially as I read the stories in Stories from
right.
Three Islands, I was very taken that there was never a whine in this, and there was never a poor little rich girl element in this, for which I compliment you.
No compliment. You don't feel very rich when you're living in a room all by yourself most of the time, and nobody's around to talk to, and so riches. I think the statement I said in the book is, I began to see people as neither rich nor poor, but either they were kind, or they were the unkind, or they were thoughtful, or they were careless. So I didn't see people, because I had no idea about money. I had my subway money to go to the school, because we had a secretary that came in every so often. But
And the way you fed yourself included those subway
yes,
stations.
Yes.
It's remarkable. It's like a street urchin story.
Yeah, it was a bit.
How did you get food? I mean, at some point you have to... How did you sustain life?
Well, I had a lunch at school, And sometimes I went to visit friends and things, but I had money to get at the drugstore. I had orange fizzes, which were delicious, and candy bars, which were wonderful.
Isn't there a malnourished function coming to play here?
Well, I had a good meal at school, I guess. I don't know.
We're going to come back with Millie Monks in just a moment. Be with us when we return. Mm-hmm. It is such a pleasure to be with Millie Monks here at her beautiful home in Cape Elizabeth, Maine. I'm Paula Gordon, and I am your guest. Thank you for being my guest. We'll dance together. Dance is a very important part of your life, as all the arts are. And I wonder, thinking about this youngster who would come, what were you, 7, 8, 9, 10? Your father was not only at the war, but he was in the war for 6 or 7 years he was away. So you really didn't see your father.
No.
So there's no male figure in that for all intents and purposes.
No.
Were there men at the school? Did you have uncles? Did you have grandparents? Or were the men absent through that part of your growing up?
I think my brother was at the war too, so they were absent.
So it was you and your mom.
Right. I mean, memory is a funny thing. It really is. So you have to be somewhat humble about what you remember and what horrified you and what scared you. Mm-hmm. And what did work for you. So
it's also, I think, important to say that when you say psychic, if one has grown up under that sort of extreme condition,
yes,
don't you get more attuned in different ways, perhaps?
I think that's what makes you psychic. I really think you're really onto something. I do think so. I kept telling everybody that all this Iranian-Iraqi business was going to happen, I don't know, maybe 2 or 3 years before it did, and people get very upset. You get into the Cassandra complex, you upset people.
They don't want to hear it.
They don't want to hear it.
And yet you had the courage, it seems to me courage, to, how was it? Was it to have your horoscope examined?
Oh, right.
What led you to do that, and what did you learn from it, and to the good, to the bad? I mean, I've always been fascinated. Why do people have horoscopes read? What do they learn? How seriously do they take it? How does it inform their lives? I don't have the nerve to ask what's ahead, frankly.
Really?
Well, it's like
that's one of the problems of being psychic. You can get fearful of learning.
How did you come into that experience with the horoscope? Was that part of dealing with the stresses?
No. Well, I think it started because the gentleman across the street who wrote the definitive book on the Muslim people was a professor at Harvard who did horoscopes. And he started off because he came over and knocked on the door.
And you were locked up in your room.
This was when I was married and had children. And we were in Cambridge, and he was living across the street. So he started it off. He wanted to read my horoscope.
And
he said I would never sing. And I was just starting to sing. I was at the conservatory as a special student and singing around town. Actually got into the soloist department at Tanglewood and lost my voice. So I never got there.
Physically lost it? Mm. Psychically lost
probably,
it?
Probably.
Psychologically.
Whatever, yeah.
That's what I was dreaming about all night. I told you I would tell you what my dreams were last night.
Yeah.
I read late into the night to finish reading stories from Three Islands. And so through the course of the night, I was assigned in the morning. By evening, I had to have not the lead role, but the secondary lead role in the opera that they had yet to give me the score, so I didn't know what the melody was or the words, and the curtain was going up in 20 minutes.
Oh, man. Pretty quick.
I was dreaming about you, Millie Monks.
Oh, dear. Sorry about that.
Yeah, well, your basic anxiety dream. Was that a loss to you when that fellow said that? Did that help you foreshorten what you thought was going to be a career?
Well, I did want to be a singer in the worst sort of way, but what a hard life it is. Oh, boy. Oh, boy. And I did, you know, Sarah Caldwell, I was in her chorus, which was fun, professional chorus, but,
And she said of you as a mezzo?
She said I was had tremendous potential. But, it's not to sing was a terrible blow. Because I love music, and that's part of what sustained me here.
Say more about that. Sustained you here in Maine?
No, on this strange place I'm in.
You mean the planet?
All you people seem to be so comfortable with. What's the matter with you all?
That's the illusion, is that the rest of us are comfy.
I know. But
how is it that music is so important? Just to you. You don't have to make a general... I'm not asking for the big answer for all of humanity or the music of the spheres.
No.
Are you simply tuned into it? Is that the way you're wired? Is that the way
it's,
you...
It's, in a way, it's like meditation for me. It's tremendously calming. And I like the minor keys because they pull something out of me that makes me write better. And I can forgive, as I think I said in the book, I can forgive anybody anything if the music is really beautiful. But then when it stops, I'm not so sure.
Yeah. Well, it's interesting you use the word forgive, because it seems to me that much of your story is to both explore and look bravely and truthfully at hard realities.
Yeah.
Name them, put the antiseptic of light and recognition on them, and then do the forgiving. And it seems that you have your own peace in having gone through that process. And maybe you couldn't have gotten to this joyful face without the full...
And I misused the word forgiving. I got into big trouble at the seminary with this because I said... I can't forgive anybody. What right do I have to forgive anybody? I mean, I can try to understand them, or I had another word, compassion, maybe. Not forgive. I haven't the right to forgive anybody. I'm business forgiving myself.
That's wonderful.
If I can do that.
That it's all,
which I think is part of the end of the book. I've begun. I suppose I have begun to forgive or have some compassion for myself.
Mm.
Finally.
And you talked about going inward. If you haven't done that for yourself,
how
can you possibly do it for anyone else?
Yes.
It's all. If I'm hearing you rightly, it's almost as if you're saying, "There's an audacity. How dare I?"
Yes.
Is that for a higher something or other to do the forgiving, call it what one will?
Yes, I mean, well, what do we know about what somebody else has been through? Especially if you've been attached to mental illness at all, you have no idea what's going on in their brain. So to forgive them is so high-hatted. It's amazing the pain they've been going through.
Yeah. And that pain... isn't just their pain.
No.
They share the pain.
They do.
And much of what I found truly laudable in your willingness to tell these stories is your willingness to say that it was a tremendous rupture in every part of your life to have both a mother and a daughter, and then one generation back and perhaps one generation forward beyond, to be living with deep illness, where if any of these people had cancer, it'd be
totally different.
So it's almost twice grievous damage.
Yes.
They both are suffering and causing suffering, and it's somehow shameful.
Yes, to boot.
Has any of that social what's the word even? How is it that you feel people relate to mental illness? You tell me, what is it about mental illness that people won't talk about it?
Well, I never used to tell people what I did if they asked me. I just said, something. But when I started writing this book, I thought, well, I'll tell people I'm writing a book about mental illness. I heard some people couldn't stop talking. I heard the most terrible stories. Other people, they would just, turn away. They couldn't deal with it. They couldn't talk about it.
But those who could, how did they?
It was horrendous, the stories I heard. Just horrendous. I mean, some mothers didn't make it, just couldn't survive it. I mean, it's just terrible.
And they were able to open up to you with their stories because you were
because I was well because I said my book is about mental illness in my family, among the women in my family, and that was as if, oh my God, I can actually talk about it. You know, or somebody would say, can we have lunch? And then I'd find out something about them that I had no idea. And it was so wonderful to be able to talk about it with somebody.
You and your husband started a, if I understand correctly, a mental health support group here in Maine.
Right.
Was that healing for you as well as for the others? Did you think you were going to get more than you and Bob and two other folk? And then lots came? How did that?
We had quite a good group, as I remember. That's a long time ago, but it was sort of, I think, one of the first groups like that for parents. And then we've, especially Bob has been involved with a children's place for mental illness. And
mental illness does not pass anybody by.
No, it really doesn't. We have five members of our family, young people, on this our family here who have been mentally ill. Seriously, some of them.
That begins to argue for looking for genetic patterns, doesn't it?
Yes, I think so.
It wouldn't somehow be the same if you were saying that five young people had hypertension.
No.
That five young people had acne, that
no.
Serious skin problems.
You can still hug them.
And you can't hug people who are mentally ill?
I think it probably depends on the illness. With borderline personality, there's so much anger that sometimes that's very hard. And then sometimes it stops for a while and you can sort of make a little, you know, communication again. But if the drinking gets involved with the mental illness...
So when one puts alcohol, other kinds of drugs into an already distressed system. It what happens?
It's explosive. There's no reins on the person. So they don't know what they're doing anymore.
And yet they do. I don't mean that they do know. I mean they act out.
Yes.
They don't know what they're doing, but then they go out and do things.
Yes, and then they end up in jail, and then they get out of jail, and nobody can keep them in jail. Nobody can keep them in an institute, because you can't do that either. I mean, unless, I don't know, maybe it's a little different today, but very hard to put somebody in an institution today.
There was a big change, wasn't there? Once upon a time, institution
yes.
was the answer.
Yes.
And then that... We set the doors open and forced people out
yes.
who perhaps needed
yes.
some boundaries.
Yes.
Let's take a quick break. This idea of boundaries, I think, is an important one. We'll be back in just a moment. I'm Paula Gordon. Millie Monks has done me the honor to join me in conversation, and we will continue it in a moment. I am Paula Gordon, Millie Monks, and I are talking about mental illness, the idea of boundaries. I remember a very telling story I heard years ago about youngsters who were in a daycare center that was right next to a highway. And it had a play yard. And as long as there was a fence there, the children were fine. When they took the fence away, the children were terrified. They had nothing. Now the road hadn't changed. The space hadn't changed. It was a definition. It was you can't go beyond here because it is not safe. And it seems to me, and I have experienced that myself with a fairly troubled family, that without a sense of this is me, this is you, this is what is allowed. But when those rules change, when everything is in play, that's hard for everybody, isn't it?
Everybody.
Wasn't that hard for you as parents, as well as the young people in your families who have had to deal with this as their own physiology was out of control?
I think boundaries is terribly important and terribly hard to keep if somebody's really sick, because there's no control, so you can't control the boundaries. It's like somebody took the fence away from those kids.
How does it affect the rest of the family? It must.
Well, yes, it does. I mean, I think some of them just, you can't even talk about it.
It's interesting you say that. What you bring to mind is a fellow whose name is going to come to me in a moment, who wrote about slavery in his family, and they were an old Charleston family. Bill, help me.
Edward Ball.
Edward Ball was writing, and he wrote a book, a very National Book Award, I think it was, called Slaves in the Family, and he'd gone back and looked at the truth about his plantation-owning family, and it seems to me, in a way, and most of the family wouldn't talk about it, they lived with the lie that they that the white owners, this is bondage,
right,
of other human beings, were kind masters, and they never did anything inappropriate in the quarters. Well, they were not kind masters, and he has all the full rainbow of cousins who were of every color because of the incursions into the quarters where women were forced into sexual relationships.
What a book that must be.
It's quite a remarkable book.
Yeah.
And as you say, it parallel to that slave universe where everybody suffers, including those who are in charge.
Yes.
Is it that kind of momentous to have someone seriously mentally ill within a family unit, that the boundaries go away, the rules are gone, the you can't tell the truth? When you do tell the truth, you got
gets confused.
Yeah.
And I think guilt, huge part of it. I mean, first of all, they said our daughter was schizophrenic, and that was my fault. Do you remember that? There was a whole period when the schizophrenic mother was...
and that was blamed on you. You did it. This is the most intimate relationship in all of one's life, is mother-daughter.
And you are blamed for doing this terrible behavior that your child is carrying on. I mean, it's just horrible. And then the same with the borderline thing. I mean, still today, I read something that hints that maybe it was me, and now I know it's in the brain, so that's a huge relief. But even with borderline, there was, the family's done this to the child. And that's the most horrendous thing, to think that you might have harmed your child that way.
Your very own flesh and blood.
Yes, you don't want your child to have that pain and suffering.
And it would seem to me to be equally hard for the father.
Yes.
Doesn't it impact the marriage itself?
Yes. I mean, there's all sorts of, what do we do now? And then you disagree, and one parent's going to do one thing and then the other. And we've been very lucky to have a wonderful Jungian analyst for years. Is, very lucky.
To help you think this through.
And think it through.
And then many families with mental illness, at any point in the constellation of the family, there are siblings to consider.
Yes.
And I would think that there would be great difficulties for the sibling as well.
Yes, I think that there is no question about it.
How did that work in your family? Was this a reactive process? I mean, what would you say about the sibling relationship?
I will just say I think it's been very difficult.
It has to be.
Yes.
It has to be.
Yes, very difficult.
And even if this were out in the open, it would have to be difficult to have somebody ill.
Yeah.
And not naming it, it just must have been maddening to not know what was going on.
Yeah. And our daughter made the front page of the Portland Press Herald. She didn't talk about mental illness, but she talked about drinking. She's wearing a thing on her ankle to prevent drinking.
Hmm.
And she's doing pretty well now for the last 9 months.
That's wonderful.
We don't sort of see a lot of each other, but little things in the mailbox.
To be able to stay connected through those long, hard years, that's a testament in itself. We're going to go away for just another moment and be right back. We have a couple more minutes with Millie Monks. I'm Paula Gordon. We're in Cape Elizabeth, Maine. And the subject, really, at this point, is mental illness and mental health. One of the things that has changed in our lifetimes is that there begins, not only do we begin to talk about it, there begin to be some hopeful places you can go to get help.
Yes.
Where does one begin?
Well, I think you're right. I mean, if some people are mentally ill, stay on their medicine. They do very well. And they have places that they can go now that help them do that. I mean, I think it's opened up much, much more now. And I'm sure the boys coming back again from the war with different kinds of trauma will cause different kinds of mental illness. And that will probably open up the subject again. But
boy, that's a tough way to get there, isn't it?
Oh.
You tell what are to me horrendous stories about the institutions to which you turned that provided great damage, very little help. It was hard to see the help in this, other than some more days had elapsed toward a day when it might get better.
Yeah.
Are there institutional answers to this? What is your experience as you move forward? You talk about your daughter being able to get some help dealing with the alcohol. And does that then affect the disease process itself, or is this where do you turn?
Well, I think if you can deal with the alcohol problem, you have a much better chance of dealing with the healing problem. I think in borderline, and I don't know so much about the other illnesses, but in borderline, it usually, for some reason, starts in the brain, I guess, about
19 years
to
old.
20, yeah. Uh-huh. And then by 50, they say it can get better.
Huh.
I don't know. I mean, I've read that, but
this
I don't know.
This is promising. But in the meantime, I mean, we are such a, we're a fix-it kind of society. Isn't there also an acceptance that goes with this, that it's part of life and you want to do as much as you can and there's only so much that can be done?
Well, I think there are places now that, certainly in California, they have very good places to deal with drinking and drugs, and I think they're now beginning to include mental illness, and that's very hopeful.
Is that all pharmacological? Is it therapy, talk therapy? How does it work?
Well, it depends on which disease they label the person with and what medicine they give them. I think sometimes they get the wrong disease and the wrong medicine. That doesn't help much, but I think that there really is much, much more help out there, and I'm sure around here too, but we happen to have gone to California to help these people.
It would seem to me that maybe the biggest help of all is simply starting to talk about it.
Yes. Could you imagine having that illness at 18 and thinking that there's something wrong with your brain you can never control?
Or at six.
Yes, because it can start very young. Yes.
And what does one do if you're six and you don't know what the world is?
Yes, and it attacks you all the time.
One of the things I found very interesting, and we only have a few minutes to sort of explore this, so we'll only get started before the next chance we have to be together. It seems to me, as I read these wonderful stories, and some of them are daunting. I mean, this is not a fairy tale. This is a very serious look at five generations, four of whom are deeply impacted by mental illness.
Right.
I mean, this is serious,
right,
daunting stuff. What I couldn't quite tell is where's the line between creativity and madness? It seems to me that some of the art and the flamboyance and the beautiful and the exploring and the brave, it's just so hard to see, you know, how do you get a sense of what's creative and what's over the edge?
I think some artists are mentally ill and some aren't. I mean, some of the greatest writers, Goethe and, well, you know, I don't think they were mentally ill, but I think some are, and they write in a ways that's probably affected by their illness.
Mm-hmm.
But I think there's great artists with mental illness and great artists without it.
All of it sort of moves away from a shall we say, boring, nice, calm.
Right. Certainly does.
Is there a norm toward which one needs to be moving, or is this all a movable feast?
I'm not sure.
I'm just so fascinated about what is wellness, what is illness.
Oh, that's a very big question. I think illness is something, at least in the mentally ill area, is something you can't control. Now, you have periods of going in and out, so you could be a tremendous artist. And maybe when you are sick, you learn things that people never learn otherwise. What was the rest of your question?
Well, I think that I want you to go back to your insights through the Vedic traditions.
Ah, those make me very happy. And that's what I really like to do, is explore that. And, you know, through reading or being with my friends in Iowa, there's a lot of TM people studying the brain, particularly. 2,000 pundits there now praying for us. Mm-hmm. But that and music, and maybe getting my dance company back to do some healing dances, Tai Chi and Qigong and shamanic drumming, heal the audience while dancing.
You've learned a great deal from those illnesses, haven't
yes.
you? Is it hard to say, and they have been a blessing in your life?
I wouldn't say that, no, because it's very hard sometimes to stay here for that kind of...
Stay here.
Suppose you end up feeling like a metaphor and a stranger here, and it's going to be very hard to think this is such a wonderful place to be in.
On the planet, in Cape Elizabeth?
No, on the planet. it's hard. So, good learning experience? Probably.
We're so glad that you find the joy that comes with this learning. And thank you for sharing your journeys on these three islands.
Thank you for your questions.
Millicent Monks is a private person. Her willingness to publicly examine her life and the mental illness, which has been an enduring affliction, is a service to the hope of healing. She has been braver than she had to be, and what she had to be was a lot. We are pleased to count Millie and Bob Monks among our friends. I'm Paula Gordon. I wish you well.